Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Be Bold America is a live bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to reunite this country, fight for democracy, and learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to reclaim our republic. Our future depends on it. Our program today is Stealing Our Democracy with former Governor Don Siegelman. Our democracy only survives by the rule of law. Monarchs, authoritarians, and dictators rule by their law, not the people's law. When our criminal justice system is used as a political weapon to gain power or seek revenge, then our democracy is profoundly wounded. In this interview, you will hear an intensely personal account of how our rule of law failed and was abused by political greed. What happened to Governor Don Siegelman is an American tragedy. His story is particularly poignant this Memorial Weekend as we honor and remember those who sacrificed their lives to preserve our democracy. Many years ago, my father said to me, regarding our country, and I quote, "The crooks have won." I can't think of a more powerful example of that observation than former Governor Don Siegelman's 13-year harrowing odyssey. We have big things to do. Don Siegelman is the only politician in Alabama's history to hold all of the state's top constitutional offices, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. When he ran for re-election as governor in 2002, he was declared the winner. But by morning, he'd lost the election when the vote count changed overnight after polls had closed in only one Republican county. There were 6,000 votes lost, but none of the down-ballot votes had changed, which is statistically impossible. And when Don was beginning his campaign to run again to regain the governor's office, he was indicted wrongfully, according to 113 attorneys general from states across the nation who are both Democratic and Republican. He was indicted, convicted, and given a harsh prison sentence by a prosecutor and judge with links to GOP operative Karl Rove. Governor Siegelman is now devoting his life to make changes in our criminal justice system to protect those most vulnerable and to limit the abuse of power so we can restore our democracy. And it begins with his upcoming book, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. It's available for pre-order now. Welcome to Be Bold America, Governor Siegelman. Thank you for coming on the program, and it is an honor, sir, to speak with you.
Well, it's my pleasure and an honor to speak with my friends on the West Coast. It's a blessing to be here. When I was in prison, I tried speaking to Tom Hartman, who has a radio show emanating from Portland. And it cost me 59 days in solitary confinement. When I spoke to Robert Barnes at the Washington Post, I was again put back in solitary confinement. But anyway, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you as our guest today, Governor. And I know you have told your story many times. But as far as I can tell, hardly anyone in California knows about how you became America's political prisoner number one. And your story could happen to anyone in any state. I thought you could just start with that very night you went to bed with the gubernatorial election having been called in your favor.
Well, I had already had run-ins with Karl Rove beginning back in 1994 when he and his partner, Billy Canary, came to Alabama. Actually, they came to Alabama after the defeat of George Herbert Walker Bush in the 92 campaign. So Rove and Billy Canary had moved to Alabama, started their political consulting business, and were in the process of trying to take over the Alabama Supreme Court. Rove actually was involved in stealing an election at that time for the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. And anyway, he was in Alabama, and I was constantly on the other side of his misadventures. It was his client, the state attorney general, who started the investigation of me in 2001. It was kicked into high gear by the wife of Karl Rove's business partner, Billy Canary, who had been appointed U.S. attorney at that point after the election of George W. Bush. But it was Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general, who stepped in the morning after the election and seized all of the ballots and refused to allow a hand recount of the one precinct in which these 6,000 votes simply disappeared in a matter of less than 4 minutes after the polls had closed. And that was the beginning of this my political and legal battle that lasted until just 2017. The story really is almost never ending because of the twists and turns that took place that make it reminiscent of a John Grisham fiction, except this is nonfiction. So I was targeted by Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general, for the state investigation. Federal investigation was kicked off by Karl Rove's business partner's wife, who is the U.S. attorney. Jack Abramoff and Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist, whom I will talk about again in just a few minutes, were all involved in laundering money from the Mississippi casinos into Alabama to defeat me and to defeat one of my proposals, which was a ballot initiative to create a lottery that would fund public education. And Abramoff, in his book, Capital Punishment, and also in the documentary, Atticus versus the architect being Karl Rove, Atticus being me, it was an independent documentary that was made about my case. But in the documentary, Jack Abramoff admits that he put $20 million into Alabama to stop me because I was an ongoing threat to their client. He didn't make it clear which client that was, whether that was George W. Bush or whether it was the Mississippi Choctaw Indians. He probably was referring to the Indians, but I think it was clear to me at that time that it was also a confluence of both economic and political forces that were coming together to ensure that I was taken out of contention for the Democratic nomination in 2004. If you remember, it was Gray Davis who was leading back in 2001 for the Democratic nomination in 2004. I'd already started making phone calls to some of my friends on the National Democratic Committee and was told, just sit tight. Gray Davis is way in the lead. Play your cards right, and there may be a place on the ticket for you. Gray and I were friends. I had helped him get into the national tobacco lawsuit when he was lieutenant governor, and I was lieutenant governor. And so I could see a Davis-Sigelman ticket would California, Alabama, it just might work. So my plans were to enter the Democratic primaries after my reelection in 2002. It's of interest, I think, to note, particularly for folks in California, that during the rolling blackout, the power blackouts and that were constructed by Enron, there were two people who were involved in that, who were on Enron's payroll at the time. One was Grover Norquist, the other was Ralph Reed. Ralph Reed, Grover Norquist, and Jack Abramoff were three close friends of Karl Rove during the time that they were all in the college Republican hierarchy. And it's of interest, I think, that it was both Karl Rove who connected with Enron and got Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist hired, and subsequently, Gray Davis is brought down and Arnold Schwarzenegger is elected, and then they come into Alabama and do the same thing, really, to me. But my story doesn't end with the stolen election. There was sworn testimony by a Republican lawyer who was hired, she says, by Karl Rove, to do negative research on me in my race leading up to the 2002 election. Her name is Dana Jill Simpson. She gave sworn testimony to the House Judiciary Committee that she was on a conference call when the husband of my prosecutor, the U.S. attorney who had been vetted by Karl Rove, the husband being Billy Canary, the business partner of Karl Rove, when he told those on the conference call that they should stop worrying about Don Sigelman. They didn't need to worry about me anymore because his wife, the U.S. attorney, was going to take care of me, and that he had already spoken to the Department of Justice, and Rove had spoken to the Department of Justice, and they were going to pursue me. But it wasn't just her sworn testimony. It was also another Republican lawyer who came forward and gave an affidavit. He was actually the lawyer for the Republican National Committee in Alabama, Tommy Gallion. And he gave sworn testimony that he had been approached by the Republican Party chairman to come to a meeting at which they were going to discuss how the U.S. attorney was going to bring charges against me in the middle of the election to ensure that I was defeated. The story, the political intrigue is one part of it. The judge was also connected to Karl Rove in that he was personally vetted by Billy Canary and Karl Rove and Jeff Sessions and the whole group of Republican leaders in Alabama at the time. And he and I had political conflicts dating back to 1994, 96, when I was running a campaign for helping to run a campaign for Congress against my judge's godfather. So anyway, we had conflicts. He had been mixed up. The judge, when he was a district attorney, had been mixed up in a scandal where it was shown that he was trying to basically steal $300,000 from the state retirement system to pay off one of his employees, who was one of his investigators as DA. And the judge blamed me for that embarrassment as he was taking his seat on the bench as a federal judge. So I was facing both a politicized group of prosecutors and a judge who really should have recused himself. Well, should have recused himself, not really should have. He should have recused himself, but didn't. And it set up a situation where it was just nearly impossible to convince a jury of my innocence. The charge basically was that I had put a man on a non-paying board, a board on which he had served for 12 years under three previous governors, both Republicans and Democrats. He was a member of the Fortune 500 CEO and one of Alabama's only Fortune 500 CEO, I think, at the time. And he was a logical choice for reappointment. He had actually resigned from the board.
Governor Siegelman, just if we could pause so I could take a station break, we can get back to, is it Mr. Scrushy, is it?
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Our guest is former Governor Don Siegelman, whose case was the subject of a CBS 60 Minutes report, which was also blacked out across most of the densely populated part of northern Alabama, so the people couldn't see it, and also is the subject of a documentary film titled Atticus and the Architect, which I saw free on Prime Video. So Governor Siegelman's heart-wrenching story is in his new memoir that's being published next month, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. So Governor, to get back to Mr. Scrushy.
Yes. He had resigned from the board, so I had to actually talk him into going back on it. And when I called him to ask if he would serve in my administration, and he said, you know, in what capacity, I said, I'd like to for you to continue on this board. And his response was, oh, Governor, do I have to? And so it was with that I sent the president of the Alabama Power Company to talk with him to see if he could talk him into serving, and he agreed to serve for a year. But he was charged with bribery as well, and served 5 years in prison for something that absolutely did not happen. Part of the interesting thing about this is, particularly in juxtaposed to the president's, Trump's recent impeachment, is in a bribery, there's supposed to be a quid pro quo. There's supposed to be, an exchange. I'll do this for you if you do that for me. Well, not only was there wasn't a quid pro quo, much less an express quid pro quo, which is what the United States Supreme Court says there must be when there's a campaign contribution setting, because campaign contributions bring in the First Amendment, the right to freely associate, to support candidates that you want to win, or support ideas, or to help, in this case, a ballot referendum for education. So not only was there not an express quid pro quo, there wasn't a quid pro quo at all. So the judge told the jury that they could infer or imply that there was a quid pro quo, and that a campaign contribution, which this CEO made to the ballot initiative to help bring about free public education and free universal early learning and college education, he said that a contribution to the ballot initiative could be considered a thing of value to me because I was also supporting the ballot initiative. It, of course, makes no sense to anyone, and I'm sure Mr. Hearn, one of your sponsors, can if he's listening, would probably cringe on that. But so here we have a situation where I'm charged with bribery. I'm convicted of bribery. I'm sentenced to 88 months in prison. I'm handcuffed, shackled. I'm taken into solitary confinement at a maximum security prison where there's no quid pro quo and there is no personal benefit at all. There was no allegation that I benefited by a single penny. Nothing. And in Donald Trump's case, the Article 1 should have been bribery, because we had an express quid pro quo where Donald Trump is recorded saying, to the president of Ukraine, if you investigate the Bidens, I'll give you the military money that Congress has appropriated. So, the two standards of justice, and I want to get into some things that are. This book that I've written, mm-hmm. Of course, it is about what happened to me, but it's really about saving our democracy, protecting our democracy, holding people accountable who abuse their power, and how we can protect those most vulnerable from the abuses of power, whether it's by a president or by a prosecutor. And there's a current example that I really want to bring up. We're in this two-month siege of coronavirus, and Bill Barr, the attorney general, orders on April the 3rd that inmates who are nonviolent and inmates who are not a threat to public safety be released immediately. Well, that brings to mind the question, if they are nonviolent and not a threat to public safety, why are they in prison in the first place? You know, why? And the other anomaly here is that the Federal Bureau of Prisons algorithm treats African Americans differently than they do other inmates, in that many are there for drug crimes, and the algorithm for the FBOP believes that if you're there for multiple drug crimes, that you're going to engage in drug crimes again, therefore you're going to be a recidivist, therefore you shouldn't be let out of prison, and therefore, under this current ruling by Bill Barr, only 7% of African Americans were eligible to be released.
Wow.
The whole system is geared against those who have no voice and no power. The government gets 99% of the indictments they seek. That's a pretty good average. You know, if you go to Tahoe and go into a casino, if you had a 99% chance of winning, they wouldn't let you in the door. So they know it's rigged. Well, if the reason why prosecutors get 99% of the indictments they seek is because there is an umbrella of protection over them so that they can willfully and knowingly present false evidence, false testimony, or withhold exculpatory evidence, evidence that would tend to free a target, a defendant. And there's, in the secrecy of a grand jury, there is no judge and there is no lawyer for the witness or for the target or for the victim's family. If there's a case like, you know, Ferguson or Cleveland or, you know, or New York, or where a victim has been killed by a police officer, and the victim, you know, the police officer, there's charges made, but it's no billed in the grand jury. There's no reporting back to the public exactly what was presented by the prosecutor. So, in my book, I explore what we could do to fix this. Let me give you further evidence of this umbrella of protection. First of all, the Supreme Court in 1976 gave prosecutors immunity from civil liability. And on January the 5th, 2010, the Los Angeles Times reported through its legal correspondent, David Savage, that President Obama's lawyer, the Solicitor General, argued to the Supreme Court yesterday, which would have been January the 4th, that U.S. citizens, United States citizens, do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. That was in a case in Iowa involving two African-American men who spent more than 25 years in prison for a crime they absolutely did not commit. They were, the investigators looking at this case were going down a trail that led them to a white suspect who was a friend of the department. So they found a young felon who was, they thought was tied into a car theft ring, And they offered him a deal that he couldn't refuse. You know, we will cut you a slack. We'll cut you some slack on your sentence if you'll point the finger in the direction of these two African Americans instead of this white guy. Well, he did, and then later other evidence came to light, and it was proven demonstrably that these two men did not commit that crime. They were suing for civil damages in the United States Supreme Court when Elena Kagan had her deputy argue that U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. And the sad part is she was right. They are protected from civil liability, even if they willingly and knowingly, purposefully frame someone with false evidence or withhold exculpatory evidence, and they did all three in this case. So how do we fix that? I talk about it in my book, and the one way we fix it is by requiring all interviews with witnesses or targets to be recorded, and those recordings turned over to the defense. It would do two things. It would deter prosecutors from pressuring or threatening or cajoling a witness into lying for the government. Those recordings, if they were doing that, it would show how their testimony morphed over time. As an aside, the person who testified against me, according to 60 Minutes, was interviewed over 70 times, spoke to prosecutors and investigators over 70 times, and was made to write and rewrite his proposed testimony over and over until he got his testimony straight. So we need evidence of what's going on in the grand jury, or what's going on before testimony is presented to a grand jury. So those recordings need to be made, and the recordings turned over to the defense. The second thing we need to do is allow the target or the person testifying before a grand jury to have a lawyer. If a witness is there, the witness should have a lawyer. If the target of the grand jury should have a lawyer, and if there is a victim, the victim's family should have a lawyer, so that we keep the prosecutors as honest as we can by having the presence of a lawyer who could object to evidence. Now, keep in mind that in a civil deposition where monetary damages are at stake, a lawyer can object to a proposed question or the introduction of testimony or witness, and those objections go to a magistrate, go to a judge, and the judge makes a decision. Yes, you can introduce that. No, you can't. If we can do that where monetary damages are at stake, surely we ought to do it when someone's liberty is at stake.
Well, I think, Governor Siegelman, I think most people, I think you're lifting a veil on the grand jury process, because in this day and age, one would think all interviews would be recorded. And I don't know that anybody realizes that a target or a witness or a family wouldn't have a lawyer with them. So I think those are, you know, really news for most people.
Well, it's really, you know, when Eric Garner in New York, the African-American mm-hmm. who was strangled to death because he was, they said, trying to sell a single cigarette on the street, there was no indictment. In fact, Bill Barr dropped the charges against the police officer. You know, there were no charges against the person who killed Michael Brown. And you know, we don't know what happened in the grand jury with Trayvon Martin, and the story goes on and on and on. And one way to hold prosecutors accountable is by letting a lawyer be present representing the family member of a victim. The idea that prosecutors don't make mistakes, I think, is shattered by the fact that over 1,500 people have been exonerated over the last two decades, and 150 of those were men and women on death row. And thanks to the Innocence Project and the Equal Justice Initiative, those 150 people, their lives were spared. And, we just can't continue this system where there is this umbrella of protection over prosecutors where they can literally do anything they want to get a conviction. Your Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit, Alex Krasinski, said several years ago that prosecutors withholding exculpatory evidence in the United States is epidemic. And the sentencing judge for Michael Flynn, Emmett Sullivan, when reviewing the misconduct by the Department of Justice in the Ted Stevens case, said that it was the worst misconduct that he had seen in his time on the bench. The judge that was reviewing, the federal judge that was looking at my case in 2004, said that the charges by the prosecutor, again, it was Carl Rose, business partner's wife, and others, was the most unfounded criminal case over which he had presided in his 29 years and seven months on the bench. One more interesting thing. I don't know how much more time we have, Jim, but I wanted to...
I just need to break. Hold that thought, because I want to hear it. We just need to make another break. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Our topic is stealing our democracy, and we're speaking with former Governor Don Siegelman. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Buddhism, Judaism, Baha'i, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. Sound interesting? Faith Matters is a unique bi-monthly program that explores spirituality, life, and meaning with local religious leaders. We discuss areas of common ground and also identify distinct differences among diverse spiritual perspectives. Join us on the second and fourth Sunday evening of every month from 6 to 7 as we have thought-provoking conversations about Faith Matters on 90.7 KSQD.
Now back to our bold and impressive guest, Governor Don Siegelman. And Governor Siegelman, I want to let you know we have another half hour with one more break at the, at 5:45 our time. And so I just wanted you to continue with your thought.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. One, I'd like to have three thoughts. I'd like to give your listeners a sense of who I am.
Yes.
And then maybe I want to get back to the story of my prosecution, because it also brings in Jeff Sessions, and who was one of the many U.S. attorneys that the United States attorneys that Donald Trump has appointed. But just in a nutshell, I was raised fortunately by two wonderful parents, and my dad was a liberal Democrat, a Roosevelt Kennedy Democrat, and anti-George Wallace. And so I was brought up in a good atmosphere. My mother was a beautician. She had to drop out of school when she was 16 to take care of her young sister. And she was a beautician from the time she was 16 until she was 72, when she couldn't work anymore because of dementia. But I was raised in a rather liberal thinking atmosphere. Not that we were immune from, what was going on or the racism around us, and it permeated our home as well. But my dad was very, very strict on with us and insisted that, you know, we treat everyone equally and with respect, and to address Negroes, as they were called then, as yes sir and no ma'am, and you know, and so we my brother and I had a good upbringing. I was an anti-war student, body president. I worked with Al Lowenstein, the liberal Democratic congressman from New York. We went into Mississippi together in the late 60s, and I was elected to the National Board of the Americans for Democratic Action with Marty Frank and John Kenneth Galbraith and other liberals in 1971. And anyway, the story goes on. My point is, I was elected to the four top offices in Alabama. I'm looking at a book, The Dollmaker. It's sitting on my desk, and it's inscribed by Jane Fonda. She had wrote a note to me because I was out visiting Jane and her husband Tom Hayden back in the mid 1980s when I was thinking about running for the United States Senate. But my point is, I was able to get elected in Alabama. I'm a progressive. I'm a liberal. I worked for the first black man to run for governor of Mississippi, Charles Evers, Medgar Evers, his brother. The point I want to make is, if I can get elected in Alabama, we can elect Democrats all over this country. We need to know how to do that. And I'd like to spend some time talking about that at some point during this show. But what I wanted to get to, we were talking about my prosecution. I want to wrap that up by just saying that it wasn't the FBI that investigated me. It was Jeff Sessions was the United States Attorney in the Southern District of Alabama. He left there to become Attorney General of Alabama. His retired FBI agents, two of them, followed him to the State House, and they were hired as independent investigators, not state employees at that point. But they were when he left to run for the U.S. Senate, and his protege, Bill Pryor, Karl Rove's client, became the state attorney general. But it was Jeff Sessions' retired FBI agents who spent 4 years building a case against me. But what is interesting, it started when the state Republican Party chairman, Marty Connors, flew to Washington to try to get Jeff Sessions to come back to Alabama to run against me in 2006. What happened after my election was stolen in 2002, the congressman that was anointed as governor of Alabama fell flat on his face in the first few months of being governor, and the polling numbers that were being shown in 2003 indicated that in a head-to-head contest with then Congressman Bob Riley, then Governor Bob Riley, that I would win handily, and that the only person who stood a chance of beating me was Jeff Sessions. So the Republican Party made an effort to recruit Jeff Sessions to run against me in 2006. It was then that Jeff Sessions' retired agents got to work. They brought this first, don't mind naming names, Bill Long was a retired agent who was sitting in the back of the court when the government folded its case and the judge said it was the worst, most unfounded criminal case over which he had presided in his 29 years and 7 months on the bench. But it was this same Bill Long and other agents connected to Jeff Sessions who tried to get lots of people to lie, but were able to get this one guy, Nick Bailey, to lie, according to 60 Minutes. Scott Pelley presented a 12-minute segment, and it's still available February the 24th, 2008. But my point is that Jeff and I had run-ins going back to the time that he was the United States attorney for the Southern District. He was going after African-Americans and trying to suppress the black vote in Alabama all the way through till his election as Attorney General. He succeeded in putting two friends of mine, two African-American women, Maggie Bozeman, who was a political activist, and Julia Wilder, who was a 72-year-old retired school teacher. He put them in prison for 2 years on bogus charges of absentee ballot fraud. And it was all a game with him to suppress the black vote. As Secretary of State, I sent the head of my elections division to testify on behalf of the people that he was charging with election fraud. So we had lots of conflicts. We were on the opposite side of the tobacco lawsuit in 1995, and anyway, we had other run-ins as well. But
well, isn't he, Governor Siegelman, isn't Jeff Sessions planning to run for Senate in Alabama again? Did I hear that right?
He is running. Yes. Yeah. And in my book, how we're talking about Jeff Sessions in the Department of Justice, I'm bringing my book to a close by talking about what we learned through the Nixon impeachment, what we learned through the Bush years, what we learned through the Trump impeachment, And I say that if anybody doesn't believe that the Department of Justice can be manipulated for a political outcome, I would call Donald Trump as my first witness. He fired James Comey to stop the Russian investigation. He fired Sally Yates, who had taken over after President Obama had left office. He fired Andrew McCabe, and then he hired and fired Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions, one of his, Southern white boy buddies, and then put in Bill Barr, who does everything he can and to protect Trump from investigations. And so it's pretty obvious that the Department of Justice can be manipulated for political purposes. And the point of my book is, people need to have respect for our justice system. If there are things that are obvious to the public that are wrong, when black men are shot in the back or strangled to death on the street of New York or shot point blank at point blank range and there's no indictment, people wonder what happened in the grand jury that led to those decisions. So we need to fix that. And if we balance the scales of justice there to ensure that innocent people have a chance to prove they're innocent, then there will be less people going to prison. There will be less men of color taken away from their families, and there will be a better sense that our system is working, for everyone. And it's really just a few things that we can do to make the system work more fairly,
more transparent. Yeah. Yes.
More transparent.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Our guest today is former Governor Don Siegelman, about whom Vice President Al Gore stated, Don is engaged in two important fights, one for his own freedom and the other to save our democracy. As Americans, we have a responsibility to protect our democracy from those who would take advantage of it and abuse their power. Don has completed a memoir available now for pre-order order titled Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And Governor Siegelman, I have, you know, a couple questions here that I tie together. One is that you emailed me from prison, and I published it in my book, America Abandoned. You talked about the abandonment of the Democratic Party, how you were abandoned by the Democratic Party. And my second half of that question is, has Democrats ever done anything like you experienced in Alabama? Have Democrats ever done anything like you experienced with Karl Rove and the Canaries? Have you ever seen any kind of political assassination done by Democrats to a Republican like this? And my other question is the abandonment that you experienced from the Democratic Party.
Well, the answer to the first question is yes, I have. I was concerned when a Democratic attorney general filed charges against a Republican governor back in 1992. It was involving the misappropriation of funds that were donated to his inaugural. But the law was very unclear at the time, and I just did not think that this particular man had engaged, the Republican governor had engaged in criminal activity, and I felt like the Democratic attorney general was doing this on bequest of powerful Democrats in the state who wanted the governor removed. Mm-hmm. But back to my situation. I had champions in the United States House and Senate. I had John Conyers, bless his soul, was there 100%, and a majority of the House Judiciary Committee then and probably now were sympathetic and were working, you know, to try to expose Karl Rove's misconduct. He should have been held accountable, and I think if he had been, we might not be experiencing the degree of abuse of power that we're seeing today. And that was, it was unfortunate that a deal was struck that let Karl Rove talked to the Judiciary Committee, but not testify under oath to the Judiciary Committee about his involvement in my case and the firing of the U.S. attorneys, the Republican U.S. attorneys, who would not go along with some of his political dirty work. So I did have support. Steny Hoyer was a great supporter. John Lewis was a big supporter. Hank Johnson, Scott, I could name a bunch of them, members of Congress who were and are supporters. We just could not get through to President Obama, whether it was because of Eric Holder and his relationship with Karl Rove, or whether it was because of a guy named David Margolis, who is the longest-serving civil employee of the Department of Justice, who was up to his neck in my prosecution, and also in the removal of the U.S. attorneys during the attorney firing scandal that involved Karl Rove back in 2006. But we don't know what happened. But we weren't able to get President Obama's attention, and unlike Ted Stevens, where they dropped the charges against Ted Stevens, we just could not penetrate the White House, even with 113 state attorneys general saying that what I did was not a crime. So there's more to the story than we know, probably more than we'll ever know, and it doesn't bother me. I mean, I feel like I got a PhD in criminal justice, and now what I want to do is you know, fix the justice system so those people who are most vulnerable have a fair shot at proving their innocence if they are in fact charged.
Well, that's a perfect. I was going to say that's a perfect segue in our last minutes of what our listeners could keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to support you and your mission to stop our democracy from being stolen and to promote your goals for prison and criminal justice reform.
Okay, I'm going to take just a few minutes to say, one, what I want to do is, I hope my book is a bestseller, so it'll get me the credibility to go back before Congress and talk about how we need to straighten out not only our criminal justice system, but our prisons. The whole system is really pathetic, and it's a shame, and we ought to have another short segment on that as well. But I want to address your question, what we can do. One thing we can do is, both Democrats and Republicans, stop talking about Donald Trump. People, working families, when they lay their head down on their pillow at night, are not worrying about Donald Trump. They're worrying about paying their bills. They're worrying about their children, their parents, their grandparents. They want their kids to have a better life than they had, and they know that starts with education. That's why I want our Democratic nominee to start talking about universal free early learning and free college education, forgiving the student debt, and let's promise every child in this country, whether they are, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their family's economic status, regardless of whether they're the sons and daughters of immigrants or citizens, every child ought to have the right to reach their God-given potential through education. And it starts with free early learning opportunities. And also, they should know that if they stay in school and stay out of trouble and make their grades, that they can go on and get a degree in whatever they want to get it in. Or they can get job training at whatever junior college or community college offers that kind of training. But we need to support our kids. And the second thing is that you know, we want our seniors to be able to have a decent place to live, and we want them to be able to have meals and the medicine they need. You know, we live in the richest country in the world, and there is no reason why anyone should go to bed hungry, homeless, or without health care. Not the poor, not those who are mentally or physically challenged, and not those behind bars. And we know as a Democrat, and probably speaking from many Republicans, we want our children to have better job opportunities that make higher wages. We know that we need a higher minimum wage. We want new uses for renewable energy so that we can combat this climate crisis that Jane Fonda talks about every Friday. So, and we know it's going to take money. So our president and our leaders and those running for office need to be talking about plugging the loopholes and fixing our tax structure. We know that something is wrong when three families control 50% of the wealth, when 1% have 92%, and when large corporations don't pay anything in taxes, when working families are sucked dry. So there's an awful lot that we can do. We want candidates who are civil, who are couth, who respect the rights of women, who understand history and understand the importance of a free press. We want a president who's for equal justice, social justice, racial justice, environmental justice, and I want somebody who understands the need for criminal justice reform. The one thing that I have learned in my quest for public office. I probably shouldn't have been elected to anything in Alabama because I was too liberal. But I was able to speak to people about their needs, and I was able to convince them that if they elected me, I was going to work for them, and I did. And so I was able to get reelected, and they encouraged me to run for higher office, and I won. I was the longest-running Democrat in the Southeast. But, you know, we have to Thomas Jefferson said, you know, when the people are educated or informed, they can be trusted with their own government. It's up to us to educate people. The right to vote is our most precious right. Every problem we face, whether it's potholes in the street or war and peace, can be solved by the people that we put into public office. So I'd like to leave your listeners with this thought. The credit belongs to those who are in the arena. Teddy Roosevelt. The credit belongs to those who are in the arena, whose faces are marred by dust and sweat and blood, who know the great enthusiasms, who spend themselves in a worthy cause. And if they should fail while daring greatly, at least know that their place will not be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. So I ask your listeners to stay in the arena. Anybody listening to this show are already in the arena. But to find candidates or political parties in whom or in which they believe and trust, work for them, help them get elected, and more importantly, hold them accountable after the election to everything they said they were going to do when they were running. We've got to make our democracy work for us.
Oh, that was excellent, Governor Siegelman. It has been a privilege to speak with you and hearing your astonishing and infuriating story. In my view, your story should be made into a full-length feature film. The courtroom chapters alone would make a great political thriller. I could see Mark Ruffalo or George Clooney, somebody playing you. Again,
well, thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you. Again, it's been an honor, Governor. I thank you. Be safe. I understand Alabama's coronavirus cases are actually increasing significantly. So I want you...
That doesn't surprise me.
No.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I know. It doesn't. But I want you to be safe and your family to be safe. And I hope we meet in person one day.
Oh, I will be. At some point soon, I will be in California and I will look forward to meeting you and hopefully signing some books for some of your listeners. So,
ooh, yeah. That would be wonderful.
StealingOurDemocracy.com. All right. Thank you.
You've
so
got
much.
It. Thank you. Next on Be Bold America, we'll be suing Fox News. Don't miss Suing Fox News on Be Bold America Sunday, June 7th at 5 p.m. Our interview guest will be Arthur West, whose organization, the Washington League for Increased Transparency in Ethics, Washlight, has filed a consumer protection and emotional distress lawsuit against Fox News for its coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. Hear the latest after hearing the end of May. That's June 7th at 5 p.m. on Be Bold. If you missed any part of this program or want your friends to listen later, catch it on podcast. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Faith Matters and Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.